Welcome to the Sunday night There Is a Solution newcomer and returning members meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. Visit our website at oaontario.org, where you'll find this audio recording, additional podcasts, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. The opinions expressed are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. We will now introduce our speaker, a member who has at least 6 months of abstinence, has recovered through the directions in the Big Book, and maintains recovery on a daily basis. After the share, there will be time to make a comment or ask a question about the OA program or what the speaker has shared. So help me welcome Larry Kay from Chicago, a compulsive overeater. Thank you.
Thank you, Donna. Thanks, everyone. Hi, I'm Larry Kay, and I am a recovered compulsive overeater, and I'm from the Chicago area. And wishing everyone happy Easter or Passover or whatever you celebrate. I'm grateful to that there are meetings, you know, that we can come to. Program for me is not something, you know, that I, at this point, it's not something that I do kind of in my spare time. Programs really become really who I am, you know, in the sense that, you know, at some point, it didn't happen right away, and I'm still a woefully imperfect man, but at some point, you know, program really became, you know, something that became a part of, you know, the fabric of who I am, and the steps. I get the opportunity to work the steps every day, and I love the fact, whether I don't care if it's a holiday or whatever it is, you know, it's not just for me about staying sober, staying abstinent today. It's much more than that. There's been a revolutionary change as the result of the steps, and that's really what I'm here to talk about. Is you know, I can tell you, you know, what it was like. And I won't spend an overabundance amount of time on that because I really want to get to the steps. But I think we don't want to shortchange the idea of what it was like. And physically, when I arrived, it's at a certain point I stopped weighing myself. But when I arrived to the rooms of Overeaters Anonymous, quite a number of years ago now, I was about 100 pounds heavier than I am today. I've been about the same weight for, gosh, well over close to about 17, 18 years. I came into the room some 20, 23 years ago. So that should tell you that I didn't get this right away. There's a couple of things that I realized that I don't know people that come to program on a winning streak. You know, I didn't get here on a winning streak. I got here on a big losing streak. You know, it wasn't as though my life was going, you know, wonderfully. And I just thought, you know, boy, how can I improve my life? Let me see what these people at Overeaters Anonymous know. And let's see if I can, you know, if I can improve on my life. No, my life was a mess. This disease had emasculated me. This disease had robbed me of so much, robbed me of relationships. It robbed me of friendships, intimate friendships. It robbed me of marriage. All that I authored, I authored much of my problems, but nonetheless, the disease cost me a lot. And I will not give it one more second of my time. The disease anyway. And so, you know, really, you know, I can tell you that from the earliest times, for example, I can tell you that one of my earliest memories when I did a food history was I ate an entire bottle of baby aspirin when I was about 4 years of age. And I somehow got to that bottle of baby aspirin. I was a climber, so I climbed up on the counter. There was something about that sweet taste of baby aspirin. It did something for me that it perhaps didn't do for other for other kids, other people. There was something about that kind of candy flavored baby aspirin, and I proceeded to eat an entire bottle of baby aspirin. I remember all these decades ago, it's very clear in my mind. And I remember being rushed to the hospital. I know that I had my stomach pumped. And I mentioned that because it was one of my earliest memories. And I was chasing, what I didn't know at the time that I later have come to recognize is that I was chasing an effect. There was something about that sweet taste. And if you're on the line today, you know, as a compulsive overeater, there was something about that anticipatory excitement of my binge substance. And my life would continue to go on where I would continue to chase that effect. Sometimes the effect was a numbing effect. It numbed out the intensity of feelings. Sometimes that effect was a celebratory type of thing. Whatever it was, whether it was positive emotions or negative emotions, when those emotions, the normal buildup of human emotion, built up to such an extent, both positive emotion and negative emotion, even too much joy, it was too much for me to bear. And I ate tons and tons of candy to kill the pain of eating tons and tons of candy. You know, and if you can relate to that, when I was in college, I stole money. I stole food, rather. And I stole food from my roommates. And it wasn't that I was a bad person. It was this, I could not stay stopped from eating. And there was kind of a built-in forgetter. You know, there was something within me that I didn't quite understand that, you know, when my roommates, for example, in college, they would overindulge on occasion with food. They would enjoy some of the foods that I enjoyed, the sweet, you know, sugary dessert items or the salty, savory, crunchy types of things. But as far as I could tell, every time they ate, every time they consumed those foods, they got all they wanted. And eventually they would become disinterested in eating more. Not so with me. The only time that I had one cookie or one slice of pizza was when it was the very last one available, you know, that I continued to eat and my relationships continued to suffer. I can remember stealing food. I can remember taking food out of the garbage, food that I would, you know, food that I told myself, I am not going to eat this food. I will absolutely not eat this food. I would throw it out in the garbage, and maybe an hour or two later, I find myself pulling that food out and scraping, you know, off whatever. And I mean, this is the insanity of this. Now, you have your own narrative. You have your own stories. I have mine. But again, some people arrive here anorexic bulimic, but they're compulsive overeaters. Some people, like my sponsor, he was 700 pounds at one time. You know, the point is what brings us together, what makes us, because it's a compulsive overeater, because it's a self-diagnosis, is for me, it's not the trauma of my childhood, and I had trauma in my childhood, and I'm not minimizing the traumas that some of you may have had, you know, not minimizing them at all, but none of those things made me into a compulsive overeater. And what I mean by that is the definition in the doctor's opinion really helps me to understand the twofold nature of the disease. And I have to understand that in step one, because if I don't understand that, the rest of the book and the rest of the instructions are not going to make a whole lot of sense to me. I'm not going to have the clarity in which to work the remainder of the steps. And that was the case for me. I didn't understand what I was up against. The doctor's opinion tells me I have an abnormal physical reaction, that when I consume any of my alcoholic food substance in any amount at all, it triggers a phenomenon of craving. And that phenomenon of craving that it triggers is not normal. In other words, not everybody that eats ice cream or eats pizza or eats fill in the blank, whatever it is for you. They, when they eat those food substances, their desire for more becomes satisfied at some reasonable point in time. It does not trigger the phenomenon of craving, and they become disinterested in continuing to eat more of the same. My abnormal physical reaction says that when I consume those substances, my desire for more does not become satisfied. Rather, my desire for more becomes magnified. My desire for more, when I eat an Oreo cookie, my desire for more doesn't become satisfied. It becomes amplified. It becomes magnified. And that's a physical thing that happens to me. And so that's the first component of the disease, that abnormal physical reaction that we call an allergy. I don't break out in hives, but I have an abnormal physical reaction when I consume any of my alcoholic food substances. And that's problematic. But it's not my biggest problem. What I learned in the doctor's opinion is that my bigger problem is what we call the twist of the mind or the obsession. And the obsession says that even when I'm not consuming any of these food substances, it could be 30 days, it could be 60 days, 90 days, it could be a year, okay, maybe upwards of a year or more. But for some reason, in people like us, we are driven back to the very thing that is killing us. And that obsession of the mind, that twist of the mind, ensures that I cannot stop from starving because of the obsession. And once I start, I cannot stop because of the allergy of the body. And to me, if I can't stop from starting and I can't stop once I start, that is the very definition of powerless. And so that's step one, that I am powerless. We all have to, if we're going to diagnose ourselves that we have this thing, we have to be able to concede to our innermost selves. It tells us in the instructions for step one on page 30 in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It says, it gives us the instructions for step one, and they're pretty simple. And yet, while they're really simple, it wasn't easy for me to conceive. It says on the second paragraph, and I'll just read it to you, it says, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves, right? That we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. And the thing about that, and it goes on to say, the delusion that we are like other people or presently maybe has to be what? It has to be smashed. And I hung on to that delusion for a long time because for a compulsive overeater like me, my desire is, you know, until I had a spiritual awakening sufficient to arrest this disease, to drive the obsession out, I wanted to both control and enjoy the food. I wanted to, but you go on a diet, you try to control it, but also enjoy it in moderation. And for someone like me, that is utterly impossible because I have the allergy and the obsession. And yet I spent, perhaps you did as well, I spent decades in my case trying to find an easier, softer way. How? If I never see another cabbage, that's terrific, okay? If I never see another grapefruit, that'll be just fine with me. Another 30-day fast, another this, another that. I see, you know, my daughter and her roommates came over and my mother and some of the family. And I don't judge anyone as a compulsive overeater, but I see, you know, that maybe they are, maybe they're not. I don't know. It's really none of my business. But those foods, to me, that if I try to pick up those foods, it will trigger the phenomenon of craving. But what the steps did for me and what the steps do is they drive out the obsession. And I didn't understand that until someone was able to open this big book and bring the words off the pages for me in such a way that I could really understand. It's not so much reading the words, but it's where the words take us. Until someone was able to tell me, Larry, these are the instructions. This is the text for how to work the steps. It's not how you have to work the steps. But nonetheless, since this book was published in 1939 in Alcoholics Anonymous, every group, every 12-step group since that time, it's built off of this program. Now, each group, including Overeaters Anonymous, which I love, saved my life, you know, they tried to identify in and they tried to write their own things. And I love OA literature because it helped me to identify in. But what I've come to realize is from my own experience, because this disease beat me into a state of reasonableness. It says that in the big book. I had to be beaten into a state of reasonableness. And until the pain of continuing to eat became greater than the pain of putting it down. And I'm going to say that again. The pain of continuing to eat had to become greater than the pain of putting it down. Because rest assured, it was painful. It is painful to put it down, right? It's emotionally painful. That's why people call me, and perhaps they call you, but I get calls every day of people that they're beside themselves. Why can't I get this? I've been around OA for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. They call themselves, you know, relapsers and so forth. And perhaps they are, you know, but this disease, what I've realized is the whole notion of the disease, the whole notion of this recovery of this disease is predicated on, I have to have a revolutionary change. I have to have a personality change sufficient to drive out this obsession. Now, I couldn't prove it to you that I was brought into alignment with the higher power of my own understanding. I can't prove that to anybody. But what I will tell you is that I believe it's so. I believe that at some point in the process of working the steps, I gained access to power, a power greater than myself. I came to believe. I didn't arrive here with a desire to have a spiritual awakening. I can assure you, I had other ambitions in life than to come to a place called Overeaters Anonymous and have a spiritual awakening. And I sure as heck didn't believe that it was going to drive out this obsession. All I knew is I kept going back and eating and eating and eating and eating. And I thought, number one, lots of people have that problem, so I was in good company. And number two, that how in the world do these steps, how is that going to result? Show me the science that's going to show that the implementation of these steps is going to remove the obsession to binge eat. In other words, it's going to be taken from me. It's going to be driven out. Where's the science in that? Because I'm a person of science. And then at some point, as the disease was doing its work on me, and as the noose of this disease was tightening its grip on me, you know, the disease was getting worse and worse and worse. And I was beaten by this disease into a state of reasonableness. It says that, you know, many of us have to be, you know, bloody pretty good before we're willing to do anything. And when I got to that point, I can't tell you what it took to get to that point, but I know it wasn't someone's words. I think it was the disease. The disease will continue to do its work on us. And if we're lucky, we'll be given the gift of desperation. And I think at some point I had the gift of desperation that I had nowhere else to go with this. And it was getting worse and worse. And so at that point, I began to, and I thought, now, wait a minute. If you tell me in step one, I'm powerless over food, and I could accept that to some extent, my life had become unmanageable. No, I still had a roof over my head. I still had a reasonable job. And so there was a lot of things that I said, well, you know, it's not so bad. Meanwhile, I'm 100 pounds heavier. you know, my cholesterol is you know, off the charts. I'm starting to, you know, experience the physical consequences of this disease, but even worse, the emotional consequences. And as that got worse, eventually, you know, somebody, they pulled out this book and they said, okay, are you willing, you know, with step one, and I said, but if I'm powerless, how am I going to put the food down? If you're telling me I'm powerless, then how do I put the food down? And they said something that still to this day has stuck with me. They said, and perhaps you've heard it. They said, this particular person said, yes, Larry, you are powerless, but you are not helpless. If you don't put the food down, who's going to put it down on your behalf? In fact, anyone who is a true compulsive overeater, you know, and they come into Overeaters Anonymous, they have to put the food down. And they have to be willing to go through a period of uncomfortability. Now that's going through that period of uncomfortability. That's why I advocate for working the steps quickly. Because I advocate working the steps quickly because it really is a race. It's a race for time to cross that bridge to freedom. And somehow I thought, now wait a minute. If this is a race to cross the bridge to freedom, so what, I get to sort of this graduation? And they say, oh, no, you will cross the bridge to freedom. If you work these steps, the obsession will be lifted, okay? But you will also have these steps for a lifetime. You will have to continue in step 10. You will have to continue to take your inventory. It's not too difficult, I still take it. You will have to improve your conscious contact with God in step 11. It'll give you instructions for ways to do that. And I do those things. In step 12, you will have to practice these principles. And one of the ways that you'll practice these principles is you're going to carry the message to others. And here I am. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know if I'll be of help to anybody, but I have to be here because I have to show up. I have to work intensively with other compulsive overeaters, and a lot of it is one-on-one, and I work intensively with them, and sometimes it's this type of thing, but regardless, that is the way that I provide service, and that ensures my immunity from picking up my food. So it really, so steps, I heard this, this shorthand for the steps that was helpful to me. I'll see if it's helpful to you. Someone told me early on, they said, and it was good because I never quite understood the sequence of the steps, the order, and how it all worked together. And they said, Larry, steps 1, 2, and 3 will get you right with God. Steps 4 through 7 will get you right with yourself. Steps 8 and 9 will get you right with others. And 10, 11, and 12 will keep you right with God, with yourself, and with others. So again, 1, 2, and 3 will get me right with God, with my whatever your higher power, your own understanding. I happen to call it God. 1, 2, and 3 will get me right with God. 4 through 7 will get me right with myself. 8, 9 will get me right with others. And 10, 11, and 12 will keep me right with God, with myself, and with others for a lifetime. And when I heard that, and I don't know if it's helpful to you or not, but when I heard that, it really kind of, you know, prior to that, I didn't quite understand. And I dabbled in the steps. You know, I would do that 1, 2, 3, they call it the 1, 2, 3 shuffle, you know, steps 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And I would end up picking up and I would feel shame and remorse. And I would feel fearful about launching out into doing a 4-step inventory. Who the heck? You know, we were all good in the first step. Yeah, I'm powerless. The second step, okay, I come to believe in something. The third step was a bit confusing, but, you know, my sponsor was reading the different chapters with me. Now he say, all's good. The food's down, let's say. And he says, okay, now, you know, now get down all your resentments, your fears, your harms done to others, your sex conduct. And I'm like, check, please. You know, like I was not ready to get all that stuff down, you know. And we lose a lot of people in the 4-step And we often lose a lot of people in the ninth step because now we have to do something. And sometimes the fifth step, in the sense that, you know, who in the heck wants to own up to their, you know, to the wrongs that they, the harms they've done? Who wants to, you know, they say that we're as sick as our secrets. But what helped me was along the way in working these steps is, and again, if I'm sharing something you've heard before, that's great. But there were four barriers. There were four impediments to my having a spiritual awakening. An impediment is a barrier. It's a something that gets in the way, right? And so someone said, you know, there are four specific impediments. This came from Sam Shoemaker. Sam Shoemaker was a kind of a spiritual advisor to Bill W. Okay, and the four impediments go like this. A secret I will not tell. First one, a secret I will not tell. The second one, in no particular order, but I'm just giving it to you in this order. So a secret I will not tell. A resentment I will not let go of. A resentment I will not let go of.
Hi, Larry, that's 5 minutes. 5 minutes
left. 5 minutes left? Okay, thanks. Yeah. Wow, that went fast. I talked too much, sorry. So a secret I will not tell, a resentment I will not let go of, a vicarious thrill I will not stop. You know, an example would be like, for me, a sense of control. I need to manipulate. I need to control people. I get a vicarious thrill. I'll put the food down, but I'm still going to control things. I'm still going to, maybe dishonesty could be, you get a little thrill from that. It could be, you know, there could be any number of things, but a vicarious thrill, I will not stop. Just something that I use, you know, to help me to bear with life, you know, and I get a little charge out of it. Maybe you have something like that. So a secret I will not tell, a resentment I will not let go of, a vicarious thrill I will not stop. And the fourth impediment to recovery was an amend I will not make. An amend I will not make. And so those four, you know, my recovery is really built on the shoulders of giants, you know, and giants are just other people that got here on a losing streak. But from Bill W. to Roseanne, to people, my sponsor today, to people that I, you know, people that I get to meet on Vision or anywhere around the country and just, you know, friends, we're all, it's like hopping the boat, right? And so my recovery has really been built upon people that got here on a losing streak like I did. Eventually they began to work the steps. Something happened. They had a change. They had a transformation. And mine was more of the educational variety. Mine was not like a white light, flip the switch type of spiritual transformation. Mine took time. Mine was more like a dimmer switch coming on, you know, a dimmer switch sort of coming on. And so the steps are meant to be gone through, are meant to be to proceed through them rather quickly so we can cross the bridge to freedom. And when we do that, I think what happens is, I mean, they describe in the chapter Into Action on page 83, someone said, well, how do you know when you say recovered, what do you mean recovered? Cured? No, I'm not cured, but I am sober. I'm abstinent peacefully. I'm abstinent happily in the midst of calamity. So no one said that, you know, that life was going to be perfect, that I would be wrapped in some sort of bubble wrap and protected from, life's gonna still happen. But nonetheless, the promises, you know, it talks about, and starting on page 83, it says, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, what phase are they talking about? Step 9. And every time I heard the promises read in a meeting, I never quite got that. You know, that if we're painstaking about this phase of our development in step 9, and you've completed all the steps up to that point, you'll be amazed before you're halfway through. And I was. And you're going to know a new freedom. and a new happiness. And I have seen those things. Even when I'm caring for my mother, she's in her 80s, and she has difficulties with mobility, and she's cognitively, you know, she has challenges and all those things. And this was, you know, someone that was one of my biggest resentments. And we have a lovely relationship today. We've got a great relationship today. God did something to me, you guys. My daughter is 26. I have one. She was over here. She doesn't know the man that her mom knew, you know, and I laugh, but I mean, because her mom has seen the changes too, but she doesn't know that man. She got to grow up with somebody who is predictable in a good way, who shows up. She doesn't have to chase after the love of, you know, of men, because she never got validation, true, authentic validation from her father. Now, I'm not a helicopter. I wasn't a helicopter parent of hovering over her, but that's all due to program. And I'm just giving you little glimpses of how, you know, that there was freedom and new happiness. And I don't regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we'll know peace. I'm just going to wrap up with this. No matter how far down the scale we've gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. I feel I can be of use to people today. Nobody was looking for me, that I can tell you. But today I can be of use to people. It says we will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. You know, our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and financial and economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle things which used to baffle us. That happened and continues to unfold for me. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. These promises, and you know what? Just like we hear that the disease is progressive, it is permanent, and it is fatal. The disease is absolutely progressive. It gets worse, never better. But the last I'll say is that so is the recovery. So is the spiritual transformation. That I have seen is progressive as well. And I'm grateful. I'm a grateful recovered compulsive overeater today. And I, anyways, thank you for letting me be a part here in Ontario and wherever else you are in Canada and elsewhere. And thanks. And with that, I'll pass. Thank you.